5.8 cases per 100,000. For Midland County, 748 active cases, 1.40% deaths as percentage of all cases, 6,137 tests per 100,000, 1,877 cases per 100,000. And since we're in this website now, we'll read you the hospital information for Trauma Service Area J, which includes both Ector and Midland counties. As of July 24th, 74 COVID-19-related ER visits, 66 confirmed COVID-19 patients. As of August 21st, 40% all beds availability, 54% ICU beds availability, 86% ventilator availability. For Texas, from the Texas Tribune, COVID-19 hospitalizations in Texas have dropped by a quarter in the last week. 5,019 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of August 24th, 1,181 less than a week ago. They occupy 9.3% of hospital beds. 2,754 new cases were reported on August 24th. The latest positivity rate is 16.2%. 11,395 Texans have died as of August 24th. 25 more deaths reported than the day before and 1,361 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $43.24, which is up 62 cents. And now here are some coronavirus briefs. New COVID-19 cases in the U.S. may be on the decline, but some officials across the country's heartland reports worrisome signs this week. The U.S. FDA commissioner again denied his agency was pressured to authorize the use of plasma as a COVID-19 treatment, but apologized for how he characterized data used in the decision. Children age 5 and under should not be made to wear masks during the pandemic, the World Health Organization and UNICEF said. Two sources have told CNN that White House officials have raised the possibility of an early emergency use authorization of a vaccine before late-stage trials are finished. Michael Caputo, the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, denied that there was any effort to fast-track vaccine development for political purposes. And Fauci said it would be a bad idea. The one thing that you would not want to see with a vaccine is getting an EUA before you have a signal of efficacy, Reuters reported Dr. Anthony Fauci is saying. One of the potential dangers if you prematurely let a vaccine out is that it would make it difficult, if not impossible, for the other vaccines to enroll people in their trial. Several vaccines are being tested in the U.S., and companies are working to ramp up production while testing is going on, so that if a vaccine is proven safe and effective, it could be distributed immediately. To me, it's absolutely paramount that you definitely show that a vaccine is safe and effective, both, Fauci told Reuters. We would hope that nothing interferes with the full demonstration that a vaccine is safe and effective. Now, here are some short articles. Universities sound alarms over hundreds of cases identified with class barely started. More than 500 cases at the University of Alabama, nearly 160 at the University of Missouri, dozens at the University of Southern California. Colleges and universities that have brought students back to campus are expressing alarm about coronavirus cases emerging with classes barely started. The rise we've seen in recent days is unacceptable, and if unchecked, threatens our ability to complete the rest of the semester on campus, University of Alabama President Stuart Bell said at a news conference Monday, 5 days after classes resumed. While many schools are grappling with students flouting their rules on social distancing, Ohio State alone has suspended 228 students over virus-related violations, Bell emphasized that it's on the school to work with everyone on campus to minimize infections. Our challenge is not the students, he said. Our challenge is the virus. A growing number of schools have backed off reopening for in-person instruction, but others are hoping that a host of new rules and adaptions can keep the virus at bay. They are requiring masks, conducting testing, delivering some classes online, and threatening students and campus groups with penalties for partying. The University of Missouri, known as Mizzou, described a new normal as campus reopened, from thinned-out lecture halls to an educational campaign from student leaders and influencers. By the first day of classes, the school was reporting 159 known coronavirus cases among students. A dashboard indicates this represents 0.5% of the student body. Like other schools, the university says it will be helping county officials find close contacts and advise them to quarantine. A USC student health official, Sarah Van Orman, said Monday that more than 100 students are in 14-day quarantine because of coronavirus exposure. In 7 days, 43 cases have been identified, all of them related to students in off-campus living environments, according to Orman. The increase in cases is alarming, Orman said. American Airlines says it will cut 19,000 jobs unless it gets more help from Congress. American Airlines says it will lay off or involuntarily furlough 19,000 employees as of October 1st unless the airline industry gets more help from Congress. The world's largest airline, which had 133,700 employees heading into this year, says it will need to reduce headcount by at least 40,000 employees. It said that 12,500 had agreed to leave the company with early retirement or buyout packages, and another 11,000 had agreed to voluntary furloughs for October. Even with those sacrifices, approximately 19,000 of our team members will be involuntarily furloughed or separated from the company on October 1st, unless there is an extension of the federal help, said the letter that American CEO Doug Parker and President Robert Isom sent to employees. The office as you know it is dead. Bustling skyscrapers and office parks packed with workers could be a relic of the pre-pandemic world. The health crisis has forced millions of Americans to abandon their offices in favor of working from home, for better or worse. Now there are signs this may not be a short-term phenomenon, but more of a permanent shift in favor of remote work, even after a COVID-19 vaccine is in place. More than two-thirds, 68%, of large company CEOs plan to downsize their office space, according to a survey released Tuesday by KPMG. The pandemic is proving employees don't need to work in cubicles to be successful, and that in turn raises questions about the value of expensive office space, especially in high-priced cities like New York and San Francisco. The survey, which captured responses mostly from companies with more than $1 billion in annual revenue, suggests that even if a vaccine were to be approved tomorrow, the shift to a more nimble virtual work model is not going away. Corporate America is accelerating its investments in digital transformation. Dogs, too, can find the pandemic disorienting. Alex Savas had dealt with her dog Miles's behavioral issues before, socializing him when he was adopted 4 years ago, helping him adjust to cross-continent moves. But the small mixed-breed dog's most recent challenge was, well, uniquely 2020. At the beginning of April, shortly after the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention began encouraging Americans to wear masks, Miles began barking at people who wore them. I think it was hard to not be able to observe facial expressions for him on people that we come across, says Savas, 29. It was like, what is this new creature I'm looking at here? Dogs understand a few things very well. Walks, how to get treats and belly rubs, what time they get fed, and whether they are a good boy or girl. They are, all of them. They do not understand a global pandemic. Quite frankly, That's something even their owners have trouble comprehending. And now here is a longer article from the Texas Tribune. Nearly 350,000 unemployed Texans don't qualify for extra $300 weekly benefit. Approximately 347,700 Texans currently receiving unemployment benefits do not qualify for the additional $300 weekly payments issued by the Trump administration, according to the Texas Workforce Commission. Some people do not qualify because they did not indicate on their unemployment filings that they lost work because of the coronavirus pandemic, said Cisco Gomez, spokesperson for the Texas Workforce Commission, the state agency in charge of distributing jobless benefits. Those Texans could change their status when filling out future payment requests, Gomez said, and could qualify then for the extra $300 payments. The rest of the people who will not receive the additional payments do not qualify because they receive less than $100 per week in jobless benefits, a threshold President Donald Trump set when announcing his action on this issue earlier this month, after extra $600 weekly payments expired in July. Some jobless Texans receive as little as $69 per week in benefits, which is based on the state agency's formula calculating benefits according to wages from the jobs unemployed Texans held before they applied for relief. Jobless Texans have said they are still struggling to reach the Texas Workforce Commission through phone calls, a problem the agency has faced since the beginning of the pandemic. Gomez encouraged Texans to try calling early in the morning, around the time the agency's phones are open at 7 a.m., and later in the day, after 5 p.m., Gomez said. There is also an option to chat with the agency through a feature on twc.texas.gov. In total, about 1.7 million Texans are receiving unemployment benefits, Gomez said, as the coronavirus pandemic continues to upend businesses across the state. When the coronavirus began infecting large number of Texans over the summer, Governor Greg Abbott closed bars in June, which contributed to the largest group of Texans claiming unemployment benefits, workers in the accommodation and food services sector. With no end in sight for when bars will be allowed to reopen, business owners and their workers have worried about how long they can hang on until they lose everything. Up to 30% of all Texas restaurants will close or have to significantly shift their business models, which economists said will not only continue to impact restaurant owners and their employees, but will also send ripple effects into related industries, including agriculture, trucking, and food processing. Since Trump announced the extra weekly payments in early August, Texans have said they've been confused about whether and when they will receive the money. Abbott did not apply for the federal funding until Thursday, nearly 2 weeks after Trump issued his order. The Federal Emergency Management Agency approved the funding Friday, and Gomez said Texans who qualify for the payments could see the money as soon as this week. But the approximately 347,700 Texans who do not qualify will continue to see the same unemployment payments they've been receiving in August after the extra $600 weekly payments expired. Now we're going to continue in this same theme of how the economics of the pandemic are affecting people. In our first recorded report today, here is a story from NPR, Will I Have a Place to Live? Scrambling to Survive After the $600 Benefits End. Now we'll move into the medical aspects of COVID-19. Here's a report on how pandemic demonstrates the importance of this year's flu shot.
So what will happen this winter when the coronavirus collides with the flu? The pandemic has already put immense strain on the health system, and too many flu cases could quickly overwhelm hospitals. This year, getting the flu vaccine to as many Americans as possible will be crucial, but even that is going to be a challenge, as NPR's Will Stone explains.
Every year when flu season rolls around, Health Point Clinic outside Seattle holds a series of open houses for the flu shot. Dr. Lillian Wu says it's a convenient way to get many of her patients vaccinated.
We could do, 20 a day, we could do 50 a day.
But with the pandemic, that's not happening this year.
Nowadays, that's going to be much more difficult because of the need to physically distance.
Wu is president of the Washington Academy of Family Physicians. She and many primary care doctors say the coronavirus has disrupted almost everything. Waiting rooms are strangely quiet. Most visits are done remotely, by phone or computer.
There's a lot of people who are hesitant to come in for very, understandable reasons, because they're afraid of, risking infection.
Wu is worried patients won't come into the clinic for the flu shot. Already fewer families are showing up for routine childhood immunizations. So they're brainstorming possible solutions. One idea is to do a drive-through, like they do for COVID testing.
The thing is, there's right now only one of those two viruses which are preventable, and that's the flu.
The healthcare system is bracing for what the nation's top doctors warn could be a harrowing fall and winter. Dr. Edward Belanja studies vaccines at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute in Wisconsin.
I think it keeps a lot of people up at night in public health.
In a normal year, the flu kills anywhere from 20,000 to 60,000 people in the U.S., and hundreds of thousands more end up in the hospital. Many fear hospitals can't handle that, plus an onslaught of very sick COVID patients, all at the same time. Some doctors hope it might not be so bad if Americans continue to wear masks, wash their hands, and socially distance. That could cut down on the spread of the coronavirus and the flu. But Belanja says people still need to get the vaccine.
It's not just reducing your risk of getting the flu and having to go to the doctor. It's reducing your risk of being hospitalized and developing severe illness as well.
The problem is less than half of adults even got the flu shot last year. This year, the federal government hopes to bump up that number. It's purchased millions of extra doses, and Dr. Michael Greenberg with drug maker Sanofi Pasteur says they've ramped up production.
There's been a bigger than ever demand for flu vaccination. This year we'll bring about 15% more doses than we did last year.
But even with more doses, Americans still need to know where to go get it. Daniel Salmon directs the Institute for Vaccine Safety at Johns Hopkins University.
One thing we know with flu vaccine is that ease of access really matters.
That could be really hard this year. Fewer people are going to their doctors. They're working remotely and can't just drop by their workplace flu clinic. Plus, many schools are not holding in-person classes, so parents can't count on kids getting their shots while there.
All those opportunities to get the vaccine have been reduced, and that does raise concerns to me that we'll see less people getting vaccinated.
Salmon says public health messaging could help overcome those obstacles. Everyone from the CDC to healthcare companies are mounting big awareness campaigns. Pharmacies are setting up more locations. Dr. Georges Benjamin is executive director of the American Public Health Association.
It requires strong, unified national leadership on the messaging. It has to be coordinated real well, and we can do it.
Benjamin says he gets that Americans are feeling pandemic fatigue, but he hopes they hear the message on the flu, because at least that's a vaccine we already have. Will Stone, NPR News, Seattle.
Now here's a coronavirus update, convalescent plasma treatment, and risks of reinfection.
We have two bits of news now about the coronavirus. The first is from Hong Kong, where researchers have documented a case of reinfection with the virus. And we also have more on the latest therapy for the disease, that is blood plasma from people who've recovered. Joining us to talk about this is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Ari.
First, let's talk about this patient who has been infected twice. What is the story there?
Well, the case involves a 33-year-old man who got sick with COVID-19 back in March. He had a sore throat, fever, a headache, and a cough. It lasted 3 days, and he tested positive for the coronavirus. Now, long after his symptoms resolved, he took a trip to Europe. When he returned to Hong Kong in July, he was tested at the airport, and they found he was infected again. Scientists at the University of Hong Kong analyzed the virus and determined that this second infection had been caused by a different strain of the virus.
Okay, so this was not a recurrence of his original infection, but a second infection. What are the broader implications of that?
Yeah, it is a little unsettling to think that an infection doesn't protect you indefinitely from a second infection, but that's actually not that surprising. One way to look at this is that his immune system was primed and ready to ward off a second infection. In this case, the man had no symptoms the second time around, which is a sign that the immune system did what it was supposed to do. And remember, this is a single case report, so we have no idea if this was a fluke or if it's something we should expect to see more of in the future.
Okay, something to watch there. Let's also talk about the blood product that the FDA has just authorized to treat COVID-19. Tell us more about this plasma treatment.
Well, people who have recently had COVID-19 can donate blood plasma, which includes antibodies that target the coronavirus. Tens of thousands of people have been given this material called convalescent plasma as an experimental treatment, and scientists have been collecting that data and analyzing it. But Dr. Lisa Ann Porofsky at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine says those are not the usual studies that a drug company would use to get FDA approval for one of their products.
It's not data that comes from comparison to a control group, but it is data that is intriguing and that is bolstered, I think, by a lot of historic evidence as well as a lot of scientific logic that would suggest that it may be helpful.
She's speaking in very measured tones there, but President Trump on Sunday boasted that it reduced mortality by 35%, something that we asked the Health and Human Services Secretary about in another part of the program. Is that number 35% accurate?
That's a misleading number, I think. One of the biggest studies looked at people who got this convalescent plasma infusion within 3 days and compared them with people who got it after 4 days, and found that mortality was close to 9% in the first group and almost 12% in the second group. You could argue that's a 35% difference, but really that's not the most honest way to look at that data.
So was the FDA justified in authorizing its use on this emergency basis?
Well, it seems to be quite safe and effective, and as Dr. Porofsky said, and there are reasonable indications it could be helpful. One thing she's worried about is once it's widely available, it could be hard to finish the more careful studies that are currently underway, including one that she's part of. People may not want to volunteer for a study if they can get the drug without participating, and the supplies may run low for the study. So we'll just have to see how that plays out.
That's NPR science correspondent Richard Harris with the latest on the coronavirus. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Anytime.
We haven't mentioned contact tracing in a few days. Some states, there are 14 of them actually, who are making contact tracing data open to the public. And here's what they're learning from that data.
An NPR investigation has found that many states are gathering data from their contact tracing programs, but only a handful are making the data public. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is with us now. Good morning, Selena.
Good morning.
What's at stake here? What's the data that you get from doing contact tracing?
So as a reminder, this process happens when somebody first tests positive for COVID-19. As quickly as possible, public health workers call them and ask them to name and give contact info for their close contacts, people they may have exposed, so that those people can quarantine. And some of the data that comes out of this has to do with the process, how quickly health workers are able to reach out, how many people answer and cooperate, that kind of thing. But you can also learn about where transmission is happening in these interviews. If a lot of people who are positive think they got sick at work, for example, that's really key information that can help policymakers and just regular everyday people make decisions.
What places are sharing the data?
Well, there are only a handful sharing the data that they're gathering right now. The best example I've seen on the where data is Louisiana. It doesn't have a lot of raw data or graphs, but there is a really detailed list of settings where outbreaks have occurred in the state, from casinos to weddings to industrial settings. And they update this list weekly, and you can see that bars, for instance, are driving more outbreaks and more cases than gyms, which is, you know, really interesting insight. New Jersey has a very cool dashboard that shows contact tracing staff numbers and even breaks down how many tracers are working in each county. And Maryland shows the volume of contact tracing calls over time and how many people were reached successfully and provided contacts. And that information is key to understand how well contact tracing is working in a state and thus how effective it is at keeping transmission at bay.
Okay, so Louisiana, New Jersey, Maryland making it public, but you said most states aren't. Why wouldn't they be?
I asked Crystal Watson about this. She's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, and she collaborated with NPR on this survey. She said limited resources are likely the reason.
health departments are really stretched to the limit right now, and it's not a trivial thing to put together the data infrastructure to report it publicly.
But Watson is really hoping that more states will start making this data public. She says federal guidelines on the metrics that states should be using and the goals for these data would really help. And she also says we've been here before. There was pressure months ago to make coronavirus testing data and demographic data more transparent and better quality. And that pressure seemed to have an effect. So Watson and some other public health experts hope that there can be a similar push for more states to share contact tracing data as well.
But it sounds like what they're really going to need in order to do that is resources.
Yes, definitely resources, guidance, and maybe some pressure from the public to say, hey, this information is really key and interesting, and we'd like to see it too.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks, Selena.
Thank you.
Here's a short report about why the novel coronavirus has the power to launch a full-scale pandemic.
Many viruses have the potential to cause pandemics, but it is the rare virus that actually succeeds. NPR's Ping Huang looks into the superpower combination of traits that have helped the coronavirus go global.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, says the coronavirus is a once-in-a-century virus.
It has very peculiar features, and the world has never seen anything like this for several decades.
All the way back to the 1918 flu pandemic. Carlos Zambrana Torrelio agrees. He's an ecologist with the nonprofit EcoHealth Alliance, and he says there are hundreds of coronaviruses in bats alone that could theoretically infect people. He also estimates that there are 1.7 million viruses living in other mammals and birds.
A fraction of those are pathogenic, and just a few of those will become pandemic.
Most of those viruses don't have the right combination to be completely explosive. Dr. Megan Freeman, a virologist at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, says the coronavirus combines a few key traits that make it really difficult to control. Some of these characteristics are well known by now.
So I think transmissibility from human to human is one of its biggest superpowers.
Freeman says it's highly contagious and you don't have to touch someone to get it. All it takes is getting close enough to someone who's infected and breathing in their respiratory droplets. One infected person can get on a plane and spread the virus to a new continent. Another trait, says Andrea Prazers, a virologist at Vanderbilt University, is when it's contagious.
For SARS-CoV-2, a lot of the transmission is from asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic people.
That makes it really hard to stop people from passing the virus on. You basically have to assume that anyone you come in contact with could be infected at any given time without knowing it. That's why mask wearing is required in many public spaces. Prowser says another trait we're starting to learn about is the virus's ability to jump from people to different kinds of animals.
We know that it can infect cats and ferrets and minks and all of these animals that are living in close proximity to humans.
Prowser says this suggests that if the virus starts circulating regularly among animals that we handle or live with, it might be really hard to ever get rid of. A community could be virus-free only to have it reintroduced by a visiting cat. So, the coronavirus is highly contagious, it spreads without symptoms, and it jumps with ease between humans and animals. Lots of viruses have some of these traits, but altogether, they've created a perfect storm virus that's causing a once-in-a-century pandemic.
And of course, we know nothing about it. It's a brand new virus.
Prowser says it means that everyone is susceptible to it. And researchers have had to figure out everything from scratch. How it spreads, who's more likely to get sick from it, and how to combat it with drugs and vaccines. She says there's a lot we still don't know, but we are learning fast. Ping Huang, NPR News.
And just as we're in the month for children going back to classrooms and college students returning to campus, the U.S. is seeing a decline in COVID-19 testing.
Where are we in this pandemic? Here in the United States, we actually don't know. And that's partially because for the first time since this all began, fewer tests are now being done. For example, in Texas and Florida, two hard-hit states, testing has dropped more than 40%, and public health officials are trying to figure out why. To give us some insight, we're joined now by Dr. Ashish Jha. He is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Can you tell us from a public health perspective why this drop in testing is alarming?
Yeah, so it is really concerning because testing is sort of the first step to figuring out how much disease there is in a community. It isn't the end all be all, but it is pretty fundamental. If you can't test people, you don't really know how much disease there is, how much disease you're missing. And right now I'm getting worried that we're missing a lot of cases in Texas and Florida and other states.
But couldn't it just mean fewer people are getting sick?
Well, it could, of course, and it's certainly that's a possibility. But when I look at the states with relatively few cases, like New York and Massachusetts, they're doing a lot more testing per capita than Texas and Florida are. So this is not about fewer people getting sick. This is really a whole set of other factors that are driving a drop in testing, and that's why I'm worried about it.
So explain what you think those are. Why are people not getting tested?
Well, we've all seen the stories about the very long delays. So test results are taking 7-10 days to come back in some instances, but a good chunk of them are certainly taking more than 3 to 5 days, at which point their utility really goes down. And I can imagine doctors are ordering fewer tests. People are less willing to get a test if they're not going to get a result soon. There are, in some places, long lines to get a test. All of this, I think, the barriers that we've put up to making testing simple and easy are really dissuading a lot of people from getting tested.
Yeah, a recent survey run by CNBC suggested that at least 40% of tests are coming back too late to be clinically meaningful. It can take many, many days in some places to get a result. How problematic is that?
Well, it's hugely problematic, right? Because by the time you find out that you're positive, it might be many days since you got the test and many, many days since you first developed symptoms, at which point it's nearly impossible to do contact tracing. You've probably spread the virus to a whole lot of folks and you didn't know it. So it makes curtailing the pandemic incredibly difficult. That's why we need test results that are quick, that come back ideally that day, within hours if possible.
You have been having a rather public difference of opinion with the White House coronavirus testing czar, I had to ask.
Yes.
You've said that we need to be testing at least 4 to 5 million people a day. And Admiral Brett Giroir says he doesn't believe that frequent testing is necessary. This seems like a fundamental difference of opinion. And there seems to be a pretty big disconnect there between what senior Trump health officials believe and what experts like you think needs to happen.
Yeah, so there's pretty broad consensus in the public health community that we need many millions of tests a day. And if you just think about it, we need to be testing not just people who have symptoms, who are sick. We need to be testing people in nursing homes, in schools, in hospitals, healthcare workers. We really do need many millions of tests. Even at 4 to 5 million, it would only be about 1 to 1.5% of the population. Many experts like Paul Romer, a Nobel laureate, thinks that we should be testing 30 million people a day. Admiral Giroir and this administration, really the only folks I know who think that we've largely gotten the testing right. I think the rest of us feel like we've got to do a lot more if we're going to bring the virus under control.
But don't you think that's a problem when you have health experts like yourself and the sort of coronavirus testing czar saying two very different things? I mean, it's confusing to the public at the very least.
Absolutely. And my sense is that Admiral Giroir really does believe, even if he hasn't always been consistent in his language, really does believe that we need a lot more testing. The problem is the administration has not been willing to put all of its efforts into making that kind of testing widely available for reasons that continue to baffle me. So he's stuck between a rock and a hard place. I'm sure he wants more testing for Americans, but the administration is unfortunately not willing to do what is necessary to make that testing available.
Okay, so let's set the record straight then. How often should people be getting tested and when?
Yeah, so it's really about who you are. So certainly anybody with even the mildest of symptoms needs to get tested because we need to find out if you're infected and if you've been submitting. But we also need to be testing high-risk places like nursing homes. It'll help get our kids back to school. So it's not about how often, but it's really about who needs to be tested. And when you add up the numbers, it does get into many millions a day.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Medical professionals have been reporting that the pandemic is also changing how people are approaching different issues. There are things that are still going on. People are not going to their doctors as much or their dentists. And another aspect of this is we're seeing a deadly drug overdose spike during the pandemic. Here's this report.
New data from around the U.S. confirms drug overdoses are spiking during the coronavirus pandemic. Rural areas have been hit hard, so have Black and Latinx communities that often lack access to affordable health care and addiction treatment. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann reports.
I meet Jennifer Austin at a Salvation Army center in Ogdensburg. It's a working-class town in upstate New York. She says the last few months have been heartbreaking.
The longer people had to isolate, it was relapse, overdose.
Austin's in recovery and works as a coach helping others. She says people like herself need structure. They need routine and support. The pandemic's quarantine rules wrecked all that. Narcotics Anonymous classes held here were canceled for weeks. When people relapse, they often wind up using street drugs that are more dangerous now. That's because of a separate trend. More dealers are lacing drugs with a deadly synthetic opioid called fentanyl.
I had a young lady reach out to me who heroin wasn't even her drug of choice. She tried it for the first time, and it wasn't heroin, it was fentanyl. She overdosed.
Data collected nationally shows this happening more often during the pandemic. Elise Alter is with an organization that tracks overdoses in real time.
We did find that the number of spike alerts and also the duration of those spikes had increased nationally since the commencement of state-mandated stay-at-home orders.
Her project, called OD Maps, found roughly an 18% increase in overdoses since COVID-19 hit, including a big spike in fatal overdoses and in more areas.
Overdose clusters had shifted from traditional centralized urban locations to adjacent and surrounding suburban and rural areas.
This is happening at a time when the rapid spread of fentanyl was already unraveling years of effort aimed at reducing overdose deaths. Admiral Brett Girois is Assistant Secretary for the U.S. Health Department.
Basically, all the progress that we made has now been reversed, and this is even before the pandemic.
Overdose deaths were already on the rise last year, killing roughly 72,000 Americans. Speaking on a panel examining the collision of COVID-19 and the addiction crisis, Girois said the scramble is on to prevent an even larger death toll.
Every indication we have in terms of stress, in terms of surveys about increasing use during the pandemic, basically everything is pointed in the wrong direction. You know, it's just a nightmare.
Girois says all these risk factors are hitting people of color especially hard.
Minorities, Native Americans, Native Alaskans, people who we know also bear a lot of the disproportionate burden of substance misuse and substance use disorders. The manifestations of our historic disparities are really just in everyone's face right now.
The American Medical Association has also raised alarms about this, about the link between COVID-19 and drug overdoses, especially in Black and Latinx communities.
This pandemic has brought into stark reality many things.
Dr. Patrice Harris, who heads the AMA's Opioid Task Force, says racial inequities in healthcare have grown more visible as the addiction crisis and the pandemic crash into each other. She largely blames one policy decision.
A decades-long underfunding, under-resourcing of the public health infrastructure.
State and federal agencies have responded to the overdose surge, easing regulations so people in recovery have better access to medical treatments and allowing more drug counseling using telemedicine. But as the pandemic ravages the economy, addiction services and public health face even more cuts, which means for people most at risk of overdose, finding help could grow even harder. Brian Mann, NPR News.
As we read in that earlier article in the program, many businesses are changing their way of thinking about office space, particularly shifting toward remote working even after the pandemic ends. Some offices, of course, won't and can't, and of course we see many students that are returning to school. Well, as we return to work and school during the pandemic, can the air inside be kept safe? Here's this report.
Experts say one crucial element in the fight against the coronavirus is invisible. It's indoor air quality. The risk of transmitting the disease is much higher if people gather indoors in poorly ventilated spaces. What does that mean for schools and businesses that are reopening? NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
Dennis Knight talks to a lot of building owners who want one thing. One thing he can't give them.
You cannot guarantee that someone might not get sick.
Knight is with ASHRAE, an organization of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning professionals. The group has set guidelines for preventing the spread of COVID-19 through indoor air. And Knight says, watch out for anyone selling a device and promising it will eliminate the risk from the coronavirus.
That's when the hairs stand up on the back of my neck and I get really suspicious that I'm being approached by a snake oil salesman, right?
There is no silver bullet, he says. Big buildings like offices and schools need better air filters in their HVAC systems, and they need better maintenance, and more fresh air coming in, and fans running for longer.
You've got to do everything, and you've got to do it with diligence, and even then there's no guarantee.
The guidance hasn't always been clear on what to do. For a while, experts couldn't even confirm if the disease could be spread through the air beyond 6 feet. Now there's growing consensus that is a risk. Kathleen Owen is an air filtration consultant in Cary, North Carolina.
It's tricky and it's confusing, and in large part, it's scary.
It's tricky and confusing in part because every building is different. And the best, most effective air filters, many heating, air conditioning, and ventilation systems can't handle them.
The answer to it is, first, don't panic. Second, do what you can.
Think about how we wear masks. An N95 is ideal, but not everyone can get one. So a cloth mask is better than nothing. Similarly, Owen says, if the most effective filter is not an option, use the best filter your machine can handle. Run your system for longer, consider adding portable purifiers, and don't overlook the low-tech solutions, like opening windows and doors. Raj Sethi is an engineer in Washington, D.C., who says schools and businesses need to start thinking creatively. Like, can you set up a tent?
Maybe you go virtual when the temperature is over 90 degrees, and then when it's under 90 degrees, you just hold class outside.
His company has designed a spreadsheet other engineers can use to help think through the different options for improving air quality and reducing risk. He pulls it up to demonstrate it.
Then I put in the ventilation per person. Then there's total air changes.
And he starts plugging in different kinds of changes.
So now as an engineer, I'm going to change the filters.
A number representing risk goes down.
Maybe I will go down to half the population.
The risk goes down some more. Sethi knows that scientists are still discovering new things about this virus, but he says engineers need to use the data we have to make decisions right now.
Look, engineers apply. Scientists do science. We have to give you a solution. That's it.
And when being outdoors isn't an option and people have to gather inside a building, he says there's no real downside to having fewer people, better filters, and more fresh air. It might cost more money, but improving indoor air quality is good for human health, pandemic or not. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Earlier we read about offices possibly being transformed as businesses may move away from the traditional cubicle model into people working from home. Well, here's another way that the coronavirus might be changing things. Here's about how the pandemic is changing how people get around.
The pandemic is changing how we do a lot of things, including how we get around. Biking and walking are enjoying a huge upsurge. But even with that, road traffic is getting worse as a lot of people continue to shun public transit and drive instead. NPR's David Shaper has this report from Chicago.
The thought of packing herself onto a crowded bus or train makes Magali Olson cringe.
I'm afraid to really take the train.
Yet she's been riding Chicago's Blue Line trains 2 days a week to her job at an insurance company downtown.
Although I had, like, you know, clerk's wipes to clean everything before I sat or touch anything, I was still a little scared. You know, some people weren't wearing masks.
The Chicago Transit Authority mandates masks and is thoroughly cleaning trains and buses. But Olson has had enough. And she takes me into her garage to show off her new wheels.
So this is a new member of the family.
It's an electric scooter.
It doesn't go more than 30 miles per hour, so I can just take it down and call it a day.
Scooters are just one of the modes that are becoming increasingly popular. Another of the two-wheeled variety is the good old bicycle. The phones are almost constantly ringing here at Cozy Cyclery. But anyone looking to buy a bike is likely out of luck because this huge shop with three levels of retail space is almost empty.
Everything in a 2020 model in a bike has basically left the building.
Manager Sherdan Weir says they've been sold out of everything but the most expensive road and electric bikes and the smallest kids' bikes for months.
2021 models are trickling in, and we have a box filled with customers that have bikes on hold since March.
But there are lots of bikes on the service side of the shop where people are lining up outside every morning to get their old bikes repaired.
Since they can't get a bike, they've dug up bikes from their basement that need either tires and tubes that need tune-ups.
It's the same story at bicycle shops all across the country.
Biking is really on fire right now.
Audrey Wenig is director of transportation for the nonprofit Metropolitan Planning Council in Chicago. As scores of two-wheelers whiz by us on the busy lakefront bike path, she points to the hundreds of cars jamming up on the eight-lane highway next to it, Lakeshore Drive.
We are seeing traffic levels in terms of cars having gone up to almost pre-COVID levels.
Here and in other cities with robust transit systems, people who have never owned cars before are suddenly buying them. In New York City, some are calling it Carmageddon, as residents there registered 40,000 new cars in July, the highest monthly total in years, while subway ridership is still down more than 75%. Across the country, used car sales in particular are up, while people still largely avoid car sharing and ride-hailing options such as Uber and Lyft. People just don't want to be in a shared space with strangers. But at the same time, many cities are at least temporarily closing off some streets to cars, turning them instead into bike lanes and social distancing spaces for pedestrians, outdoor dining, and even play lots.
This is a real turning point.
Audrey Wenig says despite the uptick in car usage, many cities are expanding bike share and scooter programs, as well as other active and sustainable transportation options.
Because the long-term problems that we have of climate change, of congestion, of constrained spaces in urban areas, those are still conditions that are going to continue to exist.
She and other transportation and urban planning experts say there is an opportunity in the COVID crisis to rethink how we get around and use urban spaces in a post-pandemic world. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Another way the virus has changed things is making people figure out different ways to stay social, but in a safe way. Here's an article about how city parks are the perfect place to meet friends while social distancing.
How are people trying to meet safely during the pandemic? The outdoors is a big part, visiting from a distance, on a porch, or folding chairs in the yard. In Washington, D.C., NPR's Nina Kravinsky found people using the space inside a traffic circle.
On a recent Friday evening, a group of people are dancing around a marble fountain in DuPont Circle, a historic park in downtown D.C. Despite the occasional drizzle, picnickers are scattered around them on the benches and the grass lawn, many of them eating from takeout containers. Grace Guerrero Ramirez and Ari Davis are eating pizza they picked up from a place nearby.
Yeah, we're hungry and wanting to get some food, but we're not quite comfortable with, sitting down at an actual restaurant, so.
They're not alone. Parks across the city are drawing crowds normally seen only on weekends, according to D.C.'s Department of Parks and Recreation. For many city dwellers who don't have yards, parks offer a place to see their friends at a safe distance from strangers. And that's turning parks like this one, which is actually in the middle of a traffic circle, into social magnets for people like Guerrero Ramirez and Davis.
And it's really cool how people have reappropriated the spaces. Like, we have people here dancing, listening to music, and it's just a really, really good vibe.
They're enjoying a bit of alcohol with their dinner, which they've concealed in their water bottles. Other people in the park are drinking wine openly. There's actually been a 42% decrease in arrests for open container laws this summer. D.C. police say their focus is on helping stop the spread of COVID-19, and they emphasize that they're doing that through education on social distancing and mask wearing, rather than enforcement. Across the park, another group of picnickers is celebrating a holiday.
It's Eid al-Adha.
Neha Mispa is from Florida, where COVID-19 infection rates are much higher than in D.C. That's why she didn't go home, like she usually does, for the Muslim Feast of the Sacrifice. This here is her social life now, and not just on holidays.
I've actually done this quite a few times to, like, meet up with people because most of us are usually here alone without our families. So, yeah, we do a lot of picnics now.
His best friend, Ali Marmel, says he's tired of socializing only online.
Sometimes FaceTime isn't really enough.
Parks like DuPont Circle used to offer a break from the bustle of the city. But in the time of COVID-19, they're now very much a part of it. Nina Krivinsky, NPR News, Washington.
And finally today, a story from the Texas Tribune. They have a feature that is continuing. It's a series called My Mask. And they're interviewing just regular Texans and their experiences during the pandemic. This particular report is about an awkward encounter at a San Antonio library.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Charlotte Martin. I live in San Antonio, Texas, and I'm wearing a mask everywhere I go. Well, at 73, it is difficult. I've tried several different kinds of masks because I also wear glasses, and they always steam up. So one of my favorite things is grocery shopping, and I can't see the produce or I can't see the prices so well because they get all fogged up. You have a great San Antonio Public Library. It's wonderful. And when this started, they put these two huge signs outside the library that have step one, step two, what you do to get your books. And what I've seen is I have seen that people park in those first two or three slots so that they can read the signs, call the number in the library and brings your book, puts it on a table outside, and you pick them up and you go on your way. Well, I parked in my regular first slot and call the number, and of course they go and get the books wherever they have them stored. All the other times that I went, I noticed that people stay in their cars. I was sitting there waiting, and I noticed a man walk up the steps and stand very close to the desk. And being probably the semi-nervous person that I am, I kept thinking, what if that person grabs my books? And so, with my worry, I decided to get out of my car and to stand at the bottom of the steps, which I did. And I was taking side glances at this man with the black mask on because I thought, he looks like he's so ready to get the books. He's going to get the first ones that come out. What if they're mine? When the books came out, the librarian brought out two stacks of the books. I didn't quite notice that. So when he quickly got a stack and started coming down the steps, I just said, sir, are you sure those are yours? Are you sure? And he slowly turned and he said, do you know who you're talking to? And I thought, oh no, I'm going to get in a confrontation. I didn't say anything. And after a little while, he repeated it. Do you know who you're talking to? And I promise you, I saw the security guard squirm. But eventually, I recognized him. And so I looked at the security guard and I said, it's my son. You know, and David was, Mom, how could you not recognize, you know, the person you gave birth to 44 years ago? And I said, well, sweetie, you had on that mask. I mean, that black mask and black shirt. And I don't know. I just didn't recognize you. So I told this story to my family. Then I told it to my mother-in-law, who's 95. And she told me, you need to send that into Reader's Digest. And I thought, Reader's Digest? I'm sending it in. I'm going to send it into the Texas Standard. This is Charlotte Martin from San Antonio, Texas. I love my library. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
We're collecting stories from Texas about life in a time when we're required to wear masks for many public interactions, and we'd like to hear your story. Does wearing a mask pose any particular challenges to you? Have you chosen one with a pattern or design you think really speaks to your personality? Reach out to us on social media or email, Texas Standard. at KUT.org.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, August 25th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. Coming up, we'll bring you the national and international news with USA Today at 2 o'clock. And following that at 3, it's the local news. Here are some of the articles that our volunteers will be reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, City Council, public hearings set for city's budget and tax rate. Economy, Insider Q&A, more oil and gas bankruptcies coming. Dead End Food Shack serves scratch comfort food. Education, Midland ISD business continues without Riddick. Elections, deal is pro-teacher, pro-student candidate. Robertson sworn in as judge of 385th District Court. Commissioner's Court proposes no new revenue tax rate. From the Odessa American, we'll be bringing you several articles that they're doing now. Odessa Strong, 1 year later. Soldier was life of the family. Marine says nothing has been the same. Santana says feels like yesterday. And another article, Design and Artist to be unveiled August 31st. Those are a few of the articles we'll be reading from your local newspaper. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas community update.
Soup Kitchen resumes to-go meals. The Midland Soup Kitchen, 1401 Orchard Lane, will resume serving to-go meals. The nonprofit, operated by Jason and Nancy Ivy and their sons, Jay Anthony and Nathan, serves lunch starting at 11:30 a.m.
Of all the interesting places in our country, the American West may just have the most interesting stories.
Following New Mexico's road to statehood from Las Cruces to Santa Fe and the enchanted stops in between.
Recording Library of West Texas volunteer Jack reads articles from Range, American Cowboy, and other publications on the Western Magazine Hour.
Hi, this is Jack with articles from the magazine Sunset, Living in the West.
Book reviews, biographies, travel tips, fiction, topical articles, historical pieces, and more.
Here's an insider's guide to the season's best getaways in the West.
The Western Magazine Hour.
Where did it come from? Western music.
Wednesday mornings at 11 and again Sunday afternoons at 5.
Horseback on the V-Bar Ranch, Wyoming.
On Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 89 and mostly cloudy. Tonight partly cloudy with a low in the upper 70s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 70s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
This is Sister Elaine Bielman reporting from the USA Today, Tuesday, August 25th, 2020. Republican National Convention, a law and order strategy, a theme likely to be amplified at this week's convention. 4 years ago, President Donald Trump's law and order campaign became a part of his inaugural address when he vowed, "This American carnage stops right here and right now." A similar message is set to echo through this week's Republican National Convention. "We will bring back law and order." The words "law and order" are words the Democrats don't like to use, Trump told supporters last week as he toured the Midwest to counter Democratic National Convention programming. The Democrats are promising to elevate their left-wing war on cops. Their sympathies lie with lawbreakers and criminals. My heart is with law-abiding, hard-working Americans. And my heart is also with the great men and women of law enforcement. Mark and Patricia McCloskey, who made national news when they emerged